Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Diecast Movie Podcast. We do movie discussions where the genre of the movie is decided by the roll of a die, and we also do interviews, too. And my name is Steve, and I hope you'll enjoy this episode that we're doing today with the Sons of the Pioneers. I'm going to be talking to one of the members of the group, John Fullerton, whose extensive knowledge of the group's history you'll find amazing when you start to hear it. And his voice is amazing, and the group is amazing. For those that aren't familiar with the group, you're going to learn a lot about the history of the group, the movie history of the group, and the music. You're going to be hearing different songs during this episode, which the group was kind enough to give me permission to play. I recommend that you go to sonsofthepioneers.org to learn more about where they're going to be playing and also to get their music. They have a nice shop there, and music is very reasonably priced. So I hope everybody enjoys this episode, and I think the best way to get into that groove is to listen to some Tumbling Tumbleweeds. And right after that, we'll go right into the interview.
See them tumbling down, pledging their love to the ground. Lonely but free I'll be found, drifting along with the tumbling tumbleweeds. Cares of the past are behind. Nowhere to go but I'll find just where the trail will wind, drifting along with a tumbling tumbleweed. I know when night has gone that a new world's born at dawn.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Diecast Movie Podcast, where we do movie discussions where the genre of the movie is decided by the roll of a die, and we also interview people that are involved in the movies. And this time, I got a really cool guest coming on, John Fullerton with the Sons of the Pioneers. And anybody that is a movie enthusiast, especially if you love westerns or if you love music, good music in movies, you are familiar with the Sons of the Pioneers because they've been around for 90 years. And of course, we're going to go into the history of the Sons of the Pioneers and how they started out and go into their involvement with the movies and what they're doing currently. But I want to say I got to see him recently in a concert at Frederick, Maryland earlier this year, 2024, and it was a wonderful experience. And I got to meet John Fullerton there and the whole group, and he was gracious enough to join me today. How are you doing today, Mr. Fullerton?
It's good to be with you, Stephen. How's it going?
It is a beautiful, beautiful day. I mean, the sun is shining. Of course, we're recording this on the day that the eclipse is supposed to happen. So we'll see how the day goes on.
That's right. That's right.
How are you doing down in Missouri?
Well, we're doing great. I can say that spring has sprung and we have survived the weather, and our cow pastures are greening up and starting to look real good.
Well, that is nice. I mean, because I think some people get upset when they have rain. We had rain for like a week. It seemed like all it was rain, rain, rain. But you need the rain in order to have some great crops.
That's absolutely right. And around here where I live outside of Branson, Missouri. We're in a part of Missouri where beef cattle production is still a very big thing. And so we've got to get that all going. We got to have that moisture to have a good hay crop, you know, so because we're going to be doing that here in another month and a half.
And just before we get into the history of the group, what led you to get involved in the Sons of the Pioneers? What was your history of starting out in music or experiencing the Sons of the Pioneers early on? What gravitated you to this?
Well, I'll try to keep this short because we could talk all day just about that. But I come from a musical family here, and one of my relatives started the music concert scene that is still going very solid in Branson, Missouri right now. And that happened a little over 60 years ago. My grandmother's daddy and another family member started a five-piece band, and that group is still performing today. They call themselves the Bald Knobbers. They were strictly a hillbilly act with hillbilly instruments, fiddle and banjo kind of a deal, but they have morphed and stayed with the scene, and today they do everything from red dirt country to the modern day things, but they still perform classics, and they're known for hillbilly comedy. And so that's kind of what paved the way for other acts to follow. And then in 1983, the legendary Roy Clark from Hee Haw did a concert series in Branson and ended up working with a local developer and built a theater. And by that time of the early 80s, there were barely a dozen of these concert venues located in a, you know, maybe a 3-mile district just outside of Branson. It just kept growing from there. And the Sons of the Pioneers, who were still touring full time, they were celebrating their 50th anniversary of continuous performance at that time. They found out about Branson and got a contract for 4 weeks, and they ended up doing a 6-week run instead of 4. The crowds just loved it. They sold out a 960-seat concert venue 6 nights a week, and then that led to basically a 30-year run up until about 2015, 2016. And even through all that, though, the guys still would do road dates and go out and travel and do concerts. But since about 2017, we've been strictly full-time on the road, which has just been great.
Well, like I said earlier, I'm glad you guys came on the road because I was able to see you. And I think one of the reasons I wanted you on the show is because, like a lot of people, I remembered watching and hearing the Sons of the Pioneers in movies all my life growing up, watching Westerns with my dad or just various things, including Disney and that kind of stuff. And you don't realize that the group is still out there. And then I saw the Weinberg Center, which is the theater that was holding your performance, had you guys listed. I'm like, Sons of the Pioneers. And I told my wife, I said, I got to see the Sons of the Pioneers. And she was like, who? And I'm like, you don't understand. It's movie history. It's Roy Rogers. It's everything. They're still out there. She goes, you know, it's not the original guys. I said, I know it's not the original guys, but it's still the original music. And in a sense, it's still the original guys.
And to add to that, I can say this, the sound has changed very little in all of that time. We've had great performers in the band through the years, but the thing that has, you know, just, it's been such a nugget for us is our signature sound and the following with the fans we have, that's what they come to hear is that sound that they remember growing up. And we still do our best to make that happen. We still do the same arrangements we were doing over 60 years ago. So very little change in the sound. That's what keeps the crowds coming back.
Oh, I definitely agree. Cause I know when I was in there, there were certain songs I wanted to hear. And listeners, you got to hear this song to start off the episode just before we started the interview. And one of my favorites is, of course, Tumbling Tumbleweeds. And we'll get into other songs, too. But the music is just classics. It's still being used in films today and other, you know, in their soundtracks.
Yes, it is.
So how did the Sons of the Pioneers get started? What led to the group forming and everything? Because I know everybody is curious.
Well, It took a little time to get it off the ground. It all happened out in Southern California in the Los Angeles area. And three fellas who had all come from amazing backgrounds, one from Canada, who was the great Bob Nolan. Bob wrote Cool Water and Tumbling Tumbleweeds. Also, there was a Missouri boy from over here near Webb City, a fellow by the name of Tim Spencer. And then this young kid from Ohio that could yodel and call square dances, his name was Leonard Sly. And they had all wound up, migrated west. Bob ended up in Tucson, Arizona, had a great love of the desert, and in high school started writing poetry about the occurrences that he saw out in the desert. He could sit out there for hours and in his mind write a half dozen poems, and that's kind of where he went with that. They all got out in there into Southern California, and Len Sly, who was, you know, he had a musical upbringing there in Ohio, he decides to go down and do this amateur talent show that was a radio broadcast. And that's kind of where he got discovered. And he was very bashful, very shy, didn't want to be pushed out front. So Mr. Sly gets a gig with a hillbilly band called the Rocky Mountaineers. And they had no singers. They hired him strictly upon his vocal ability, but he begged them. He said, "Guys, I would like to do a vocal trio." And a lot of that was just to cover up his shyness. He was scared to death to be out front as a solo performer. Well, anyway, he puts out ads in the LA Examiner newspaper. This was back in the fall of 1931, and Bob Nolan was living in Los Angeles area at that time, and Bob saw this ad for a harmony yodeler, so he answered the ad by showing up for an audition. Len Sly grabbed him strictly because of his ability to yodel. Bob was a great yodeler. And so they worked together in the Rocky Mountaineers. That morphed into a couple of other bands into the early 1930s. They found Tim Spencer when Bob decided to actually bail out for a little while. There just was not a lot in the way of pay coming in for these guys. And I'll be honest with you, they were starving to death. It was tough times in the early 30s as things were deepening, you know, in that era of the Great Depression. That did, you know, over time make its way to California. But Tim got in there and started songwriting. Bob was taking his poems that he had written in Arizona and started dusting them off one by one and turning them into just the most beautiful works musically. And it kind of went from there. They was able to get Bob to come back on and join them in 1933. And by this time they were in a group called Jack and the Texas Outlaws. And they were using the name Pioneer Trio for their portion of this radio program. And this was at Warner Brothers. They were all staff musicians, and things started looking upward. And all of a sudden, the Pioneer Trio had this better vocal blend and better tone quality than any other group out there in that area. So they start getting this huge fan following, and folks were actually coming to the studio to try to watch them perform live, and it just went from there. Soon, Warner Brothers gave them their own shows, three and four broadcasts a day. They were sponsored by a dry clean clothing service, and it just took off from there. And in early 1934, they, by that point, had a fiddler on board to complement their deep vocal harmonies, and their announcer, just one morning out of the blue, made up the name, instead of calling them the Pioneer Trio, because here they are, there's four guys standing on stage. This doesn't look right, you know? And so the announcer just out of the blue made up the new name and said, "Here they are, the Sons of the Pioneers." The four fellows all had blank looks on their faces, but got the program off to a little bit of a shaky start, but got through it. And after that program was done, they all voted on it right there and thought, you know, maybe this is all right. Let's go this path with the new name. And they were the Sons of the Pioneers from that point forward. And now you fast forward to today. They've had an incredible run, over 100 film appearances and quite a number of films where the Pioneers did soundtrack work over the years, hundreds upon hundreds of live radio broadcasts, hundreds of television appearances, you know, live touring, personal appearances, all the way to today. The group is still going strong, and we've now had a total of 47 members in 90 years, still going strong.
And what amazes me is, besides the 90 years, because I can't think of any other groups that have had 90 continuous years at all. Maybe a band's, you know, like, or orchestras, but singing groups. I can't imagine.
Right. There is one group right behind us as far as longevity that has went all these years without a hitch, and that's the gospel group, the Chuckwagon Gang. But there for a while, even when they were starting out in Texas, they did cowboy songs and some Western as well, but they have primarily remained all gospel, and they are still touring and recording and have a fabulous sound, and they're right behind us maybe by all of 2 years, if even that.
And they're just like, come on, guys, take a little hiatus. We can pass you. And it's like, no.
Right.
But also, only 47 different members during that span is just incredible.
It really is. And what has always blown me away is the longevity. We had a member that came on board in 1953, and he stayed with our band for 56 years. So that's these guys put their whole heart and soul into it and made a lifetime career out of it. And several of the other fellas as well stayed until they could not do it anymore. We've actually had we've had a few of the members who actually passed away while still involved in the group. So yeah, a big thing. We've had such great guys that just totally put their heart into it.
And you can tell when you listen to the music that you guys really care about it. And I know some people say, well, they're singing the same songs. Do they have that same intensity? And I can see from watching you guys, you do. And I think part of the reason is you guys have had such longevity and enjoyment in your performances is the audience is energizing you when they're hearing you guys perform.
That's absolutely right.
And it's just, I was at that crowd and it was just a great experience going through all that. Now, you brought up you guys have had over 100 different appearances in movies, TV shows, everything, whether it's feature length, shorts, and so on. And of course, Leonard Sly went on to become Roy Rogers and then went on to be known as the King of the Cowboys. What was it like for the group in that transitional phase when he left the group, you know, to become basically like a solo act, and how did the transition?
Well, going back to that part of that all unfolded in late 1937, and leading up to that, the fellas had just a hair over maybe a dozen film appearances already under their belt, where they had done shorts, they had done full length features, they had managed to wiggle their way among, I'd say perhaps maybe five of the major movie studios. I mean, they had done work for Warner Brothers, Universal, Liberty, MGM, and Columbia. And here they had just gotten a full-length contract for like 6 years at Columbia with Charles Sterrett. They were going to back him up and do everything from riding horseback in the chase scenes to doing all the musical, you know, chores as well. And they finished this movie called The Old Wyoming Trail. And they had sang several of Bob Nolan's compositions in that. And all of a sudden, Len Sly says, hey, I went over to Universal and I did a screen test and I didn't get the job, but I'm thinking about advancing. And I think I could, you know, front my own Western series type of a deal and be a player here, you know? So they all granted him, that opportunity to go do what he wanted. But at the same time, he had to approach Columbia to get himself out of the contract to advance. And Columbia graciously told him, if you feel okay in moving on, go for it. But you have to replace yourself in the Sons of the Pioneers. And if you do that, everything will be just fine. So right as production was beginning on this second motion picture, and this is like in October of 1937, they found Pat Brady, who had been one of Roy's real good friends. They had known Pat among the club scene there in Los Angeles, but he was a great bass player. They tried to work him in to be one of the vocalists in the vocal trio, and Pat had a little bit of difficulty just understanding the phrasing, the breathing, and the chord structure that the Pioneers, that sound and the vocal trio that they were so well known for. Pat had a bit of difficulty adjusting to that. So to get them by, Columbia was using a second lead actor by the name of Donald Grayson in these films. So they were giving Grayson a lot of that extra vocal work while the Pioneers were trying to figure out what their next move would be. Well, they decided that Tim Spencer would drop to the middle voice part. Bob Nolan would stay at the baritone part. And just prior to Roy bailing out, they had found a kid from out here in Arkansas, Lloyd Perryman, who had been in California for just a short time. They decided to adjust the trio to where Lloyd would be that tenor voice. And so they had it all down. They figured it out. And next thing you know, they end up doing 30 motion pictures with Charles Sterrett going all the way into 1941, while Roy Rogers at his Republic Pictures deal starts paving the way with his own series. And that was all because Gene Autry had walked out and went on strike, but Gene did come back. But they had already invested so much into getting Roy off the ground, they let him continue. And that's where it all took off. That was the transition of Roy getting out of the Sons of the Pioneers. And by the time they were up for a contract renewal, Roy heard that the Pioneers were available. This was in the late summer of 1941, and the Pioneers said, Roy, we probably will not renew at Columbia. And so that's when Roy persuaded the powers that be, Herbert Yates and everybody there at Republic, to get the Pioneers in. Sure enough, they did. So they signed a 7-year deal, and that took place from that point all the way into late 1948. You saw Roy and the Pioneers in 44 feature films. And that's where the folks really, really remember them.
Yeah, as I say, that's mostly where I remember them too, because those are the ones I would see on TV. You know, when you're watching on Saturday and they'd have like the Western movie of the week, and it rotated around. Of course, there was lots of John Wayne movies and so on. But I always looked at when they had these ones that I wasn't as familiar with, and my dad would be there and he'd be like, "Oh yeah," and he would know everybody, you know, because it's just like dads always do. Oh, this is that guy and that's this guy. And you're able to know what was going on. And then you just start to realize, oh, this is kind of cool, because it's a different vibe than, you know, your normal Western that I would have saw in the 70s growing up, you know, where it's just like, oh, you used all these shootouts, and here you have the shootouts, but you also have songs going with them also. And it was pretty cool, because I liked musicals also. And this was like a combination of the two.
That's exactly right. And I will tell you this, because these motion pictures were geared toward, you know, the younger fans, they did everything they could to keep the violence down. You know, if there was gunshots, and of course there were, but when gunshots took place, the studios all made certain that there was no blood involved. You wouldn't even see any of that. And this brings up a funny story. They were doing one of the Charles Sterrett films. It was one of the early ones there at Columbia. And in this particular scene, Charles Sterrett gets his finger shot off, and they went in with the special effects and made it so realistic that it bothered a lot of the young kids. And all of a sudden, Columbia got hate mail for weeks. I mean, they got hate mail from schools, parents, churches, you name it. And that's when Columbia made up their mind, okay, we can't do this anymore. We've got to keep this very kid friendly. And so that's the way all those studios went from that point forward. They kept the violence level very low key.
Yeah, it's there, but it doesn't have to be up in your face and showing.
That's right. Exactly.
And I think the key to that is that it was entertaining for parents that are bringing their children, and then of course the children themselves is pretty obvious because of the success that they had.
Absolutely.
And I guess that leads to the success of the group overall, because besides the music being out there, when you have the films and you're especially hitting a younger audience, when they grow up, I think we've all had this when we grow up, and we're used to watching these things when we were youngsters, and then you hit your 30s and you have that little wave of nostalgia and you want to go back to it. So I think when television came around and was in its heyday, and then suddenly the Sons of the Pioneers movies were showing up on TV, that was a way for the parents then to have their children watch it. So they were, because they knew, oh, this is fun entertainment. You're going to enjoy it because I enjoyed it when I was a child.
Exactly. And you know, that right there, that movement kind of kept repeating itself as the years went by, because by the time those children of the 1950s were now in college in the 1970s, the pioneers were still very active, doing nearly 300 days a year. And it was kind of a wake up call, like, oh my gosh, that's the same Sons of the Pioneers that I saw 20 plus years ago in films, even though it was footage from the 1940s that these kids' mom and dads encountered. So it's kind of cool how it just all of a sudden went generation to generation. And that's what's kept us going. It blows me away every time.
And like you said, it's still happening today. And
yes,
your crowd had a wide range of ages in it. And I think it just shows the testimony of TV as a medium and movies and how music are all intertwined to keep things relevant in the later years.
Absolutely. Spot on. Yeah, I was, and we've been seeing this just about everywhere we go. We have been seeing it here just lately. Again, the surge of young families with their kids, and some of these concerts we do, we've had some of these youngsters, and I'm talking, you know, from 8 and 9 years old up to early teens, who ask about certain songs. They know the songs. They recognized certain pioneers from the films because their parents are introducing them to it. And it just really makes us super, super happy that this is still continuing.
If I had to pick, and this is hard for me to say, because everybody always says, like, what's your favorite song of a group? And I'm not even going to ask you yours, because that, to me, that'd be an impossible thing. But I think your answer might be similar to mine, and your favorite varies on the mood you're in at that particular time, or what you want to hear, or in your case, sing. Would that be a similar answer?
There is a lot of truth in that. I can narrow it down to three, if not four, numbers that are probably my favorites. And of course, our big hits, of course, being Tumbling Tumbleweeds and Cool Water.
Day I faced a barren waste without the taste of water, cool water.
Water.
Old Dan and I, with throats burned dry and souls that cry for water,
water,
cool
water.
Bob Nolan standards, I never get tired of. I as long as the crowd keeps hooting and hollering and wanting to hear it, I'll sing it all night. It doesn't bother me a bit. I'm a huge fan of Ghost Riders in the Sky, and the fellow that wrote that number, who was a longtime park ranger out in California at Death Valley, not only did he write that one, but he wrote dozens of other fine songs too, and the Pioneers covered a lot of those through the years as well. Stan Jones was just a songwriting genius, and he actually ended up landing a fairly steady gig as a scout during some of those John Wayne productions of the early and mid 1950s. And once those movie executives realized Stan's talent as a writer, they put him to work. And if you watch John Wayne and Maureen O'Hara in Rio Grande, there are several of Stan's original compositions. One of my favorites is My Gal is Purple. I think that is one of the most beautifully written numbers. And the Sons of the Pioneers were in that film and just had the harmonies extremely polished. But I think one of Stan's all-time greats on film is The Searchers, with John Wayne and Jeffrey Hunter and all those guys in March of 1956. I think that's one of the most beautiful numbers also ever written.
The Searchers is one of my favorite Westerns of all time. And you just added another element to it because of the music that's going on in the movie and the soundtrack. And it's just a great movie. If people haven't seen The Searchers, you've got to see The Searchers.
To me, I think The Searchers ranks probably, to me, this is my opinion, I feel it's definitely probably a top five of the all-time greatest Westerns ever released, definitely a top five.
Oh, you're not going to get an argument from me at all. But if I had to pick one favorite right now, as I'm feeling it, it's always been, as you already mentioned, one of your favorites, Cool Water, is just such. You hear it all the time in sometimes in commercials and, like we said, other TV shows, movies. It's constantly being either the Sons of the Pioneers version or reinterpreted with another group doing it. It's a classic song that still resides today with audiences.
Yes, and we saw quite the comeback with Cool Water as far as the popularity continuing, you know, extending further. In just recent years, the children's motion picture Ringo, the animated feature, it had Cool Water in it. And that's been probably, 11 or 12 years ago. But all of a sudden, we would see another surge of youngsters in our audiences, all because of that. So, yeah, it's great how every few years, either Cool Water or Tumbling Tumbleweeds gets thrown back into a major motion picture, and there's another wave of success off of it. It's just great how all that works out.
Yeah, and that's what I was meaning about being reintroduced to people. And I think talking about movies that get reintroduced, Disney is always notoriously known to have movies go out, then they put them in the vault, and they bring them back out again, you know, especially back in the early days, where so people can always be re-exposed to them at later generations. And you guys were involved in Melody Times with Pecos Bill.
That's right, and Disney realized how big that particular package was, that when it celebrated its 50th anniversary, I believe, they reissued it and put it out on DVD, remastered the whole thing, and put it out on DVD, and that was in 1998, and the Disney collectors, the fans just went absolutely crazy over that. I remember in high school, I was looking everywhere for even a VHS copy, and hardly any existed unless you bumped into some video rental organization in your hometown that might have it, but it was very difficult to find. And a member of the Pioneers actually had a VHS copy, and he ran one off for me, made me a duplicate of it. And that's how I first saw it. And I was just blown away with it. But then to see that DVD version come out in 1998, man, that was the icing on the cake. And I still think that's probably one of the greatest vocal performances on film of all time, featuring Roy and the Pioneers together.
I mean, I was rewatching it just recently, a few days ago, and Blue Shadows on the Trail opening up that segment is just,
yes,
so well done with the animation and the vocal harmonies. It just works so well together.
Absolutely, it does. Yeah, we still get great enjoyment performing Blue Shadows in our live concerts, and we still sing it exactly that same way that it was performed in the film.
And what was the history of Disney getting the Roy Rogers and the Sons of the Pioneers to do that? Because I know you, being the group historian, would know that more than anybody.
You know, from what I can gather, you know, they had a number, the entire Melody Time feature featured other acts and other bands. And I think it was just trying to grab up some of the popular performers of the day and kind of merge them all and have them all take part in one feature film release. And I think Disney nailed it on the head by setting the tone by having, you know, the best for the last part of the feature. It's a whole mishmash of things when you watch the entire Melody length production, but you get to the very end of it and the last 22 minutes is the feature with Pecos Bill and explaining why the coyotes howl at the moon at night. I'm not sure exactly what probably drew Disney to choose Roy and the guys, except that they were on top. They were the number one box office stars. Roy Rogers was the number one box office selling actor. And it was the perfect package of Roy and the Pioneers together. There was no other way to do it. And when they did get it all finalized and announced that, okay, we're going to bring you guys onto a Disney stage and we're going to draw a cartoon around you, they're saying like, what? We've never heard of that before. And it was very historic for Disney because this was like their first time to put human beings and animation together all in the same spot, you know. And it worked out very, very well. It was just a huge, huge success.
I enjoy it. My children, because we have Fantasia, and of course we have, yes, Melody Time, and this was Disney. Melody Time was Disney's redo of Fantasia instead of classical music, like you already brought up, acts that were popular at the time, and have stories go around them. And what I love about it, as a person who loves film, but also who loves history, it encapsulates what was popular at that particular time.
Yes, exactly.
And I just love how the group sings the songs, and with the animation, like I said, going with it, it's just I don't know. I really, really enjoy it. My children enjoyed it when they saw it for the first time, and I remembered when I hadn't seen Melody Time in decades by the time I showed it to them, and I'd forgotten about, like, you know, who's in it or whatever. And of course, you get there, and it's like, oh, that's Roy Rogers, Sons of the Pioneers. And that's when they asked me about the group and Roy Rogers, and that's when I was able to say, oh, there's these other things, and I can show you this and that. And that, so Melody Time was the gateway for them to learn about you guys.
You know, and I tell you what, Disney had it all figured out from the marketing standpoint, too. And what even furthered, I think, the success even more was, you know, they allowed RCA to do a great promo by releasing, I wouldn't call it a soundtrack necessarily, but it's very similar. What they did was they had Roy and the Pioneers go in the RCA studio and cut maybe a slightly shorter version of the series just for audio purposes. And it came out and was released on a recorded set of three 78 RPM album or records, you know. And this album set had the little booklet that went with it, and the kids could kind of read along as they turned the pages, and some of Disney's animation was put into this as well. But that is one of the most collectible items today of the Roy Rogers Sons of the Pioneers collectibles, is having those. That it's a kind of a red colored jacket with yellow graphic, and it's got Roy's photo and the Pioneers photo on the front, and the Pecos Bill cartoon character on the front. But it's probably one of my favorite recorded musical sets ever done. And then as time goes by, you know, as we see the trend in recordings improve, later on, RCA reissued it with Disney's permission, put it out as a 45 RPM set. And then by the 60s, you could still buy that thing. You could still buy it as a 12-inch 33 LP record. And Johnny Appleseed was on the flip side.
Shades of night are falling as the wind begins to sigh, and the world is silhouetted against the sky. Ooh, and drifting on the evening breeze. Move along, blue shadows, move along. Soon the dawn will come and you'll be on your way. But until the darkness sheds its veil,
that's just amazing to me how things how things keep repeating themselves. And of course now, you know, music is available in so many different formats. You know, there's the MP3 or digital versions. There's also yes. the vinyl still out there. You still have some things that are put out on cassette on occasion. It's amazing to me how you can listen to it almost any which way, because I know there's a difference between all three of them. And there's something yeah. about putting a record on and dropping the needle in that right spot, and it's hearing the warmth of the harmonies in the music.
Absolutely. You know, I'm still old school. I still have my setup here at home to play the 78s and the 45s. I've got an old Montgomery Ward turntable belt driven from 1965 that belonged to one of my family members. And I still keep that thing in use, because there's just something about hearing that little dab of surface noise, you know, when the needle hits it. It's just, man, it's just awesome. There's just nothing like it. Now, don't get me wrong, I love hearing the studio quality of a lot of the remastered projects through the years that have come out in the CD age. I never dreamed as a kid that I could hear some of these songs in studio master quality, but there's still something about hearing it in that original form. It just gets me every time.
And just to go a little bit into music, I find one of the things I love about acts that have been around for years, and when you get it in the older formats, is when they sometimes remaster things nowadays or record things if they're being current, they overproduce it, and sometimes you lose the warmth of the voice. There's little nuances in it, because it gets just a little bit, corrected, and it doesn't sound the same as when you hear them yes. live or when you hear the record. And what's that been like with you guys in recordings? Which method do you guys prefer and do?
Well, I'll tell you this. One thing that I have noticed in, you know, the transfer of recordings to this to the digital age, especially. And in particular, I would say probably the MP3 format. And I think that's where some have went too far, to the point that they've not only destroyed the integrity of the recording, it's messed up the pitch. It's not even in the same key as it was placed in its original format. And that's one thing that that I've done, especially with the Sons of the Pioneers radio broadcast through the years. I get some of these that are as much as 6% and 8% off. Either they're too high or they're too low. And I know the Pioneer voices, and I know how they're supposed to sound. And I can tell if they're off a half step, you know, I know that if I hear Tumbling Tumbleweeds and something other than the key of C, something ain't right. And so I've spent hours, I've spent years for my personal collection of Pioneers radio shows of actually tweaking them and putting them back in tune the way they were supposed to be, just so that they sound right, because it just drives my ears crazy to hear it any other way.
And for listeners don't know, once you hear it, a certain song the correct way, or the way it's meant to be, I should say, maybe not, maybe correct, because everybody has different appreciations. It's, but when you know, you know. It's like you can never hear it the same way again.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I don't knock folks for their efforts, because so many do mean well, especially some of the companies overseas that have done a great job in re-releasing some of the 1930s and 1940s era recording sessions, but they've tried to crowd too much material onto a CD, and so to do that, they have sped up the recordings 3 to 5%, and again, you can clearly tell it's off. But I've always went with the theory, folks, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Come on, you know.
I'm agreeing with you, and I know this is not a Sons of the Pioneers song, but it, for listeners that love songs, Billy Joel's Turn the Lights Back On. I heard it when it, you know, came out, and I was like, oh, this is great. I love this song. And then I heard him play it at the Grammys, and I was like, wow, that's a little different. And then, of course, it's on YouTube, but you can find it now, like the Grammy version. And I would listen to the one that was on, let's say, Spotify or whatever, and then I would listen to the Grammy version, and the Grammy version was so much better of him doing it live. And I realized that's when it dawned on me about somebody probably in the production part corrected things and changed things that Billy Joel did not want to have happen, obviously, because he did it in the live version this way. And it's just so much warmer, and you can feel the music better. You can feel the points better. And I think that goes back to what you're saying. When you're listening to the Sons of the Pioneers radio things, you can just, it's just not landing the way it should be.
Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely.
But I guess, you know, people are now going to say we're music snobs, but it's just, I don't know. It's this, when you're used to hearing something a certain way, it's weird when you hear it wrong. Not wrong.
Yeah,
but
totally. Yes, totally true.
But going back to the movies that the Sons of the Pioneers were in, what are some of the ones that you would recommend for people to get an idea of what the Sons of the Pioneers were like in their movie career? Like, what would be a couple that you would recommend and why?
Well, I think probably the best of the best as far as what they did with Charles Sterrett. There was a release they did, if I'm not mistaken, it was in 1940. It came out, and it's actually called The Durango Kid, and it caused such a stir. It did so well in box offices that Columbia decided to kind of give that title to Charles Sterrett. So from that point, they launched the Durango Kid series of Charles Sterrett films. Well, anyway, the Pioneers, along with Bob Nolan, all had just excellent parts, excellent music. I want to say there's maybe five numbers total in that. I love their arrangement of a Tim Spencer composition called There's a Rainbow Over the Range. They sang that one during a work scene in a near a barn and a horse corral, and kind of put a little bit of a comedy edge on it with Pat Brady, because Pat was always getting into trouble and always goofing off. But I think that's one of the best of the film appearances, the Pioneers and Charles Sterrett. Now, when you get to some of the Gene Autry stuff, if you've never seen it, go back and watch that Republic Pictures release, The Old Corral, from 1936, where Roy is still Lynn Sly at the time of that release. And the five Pioneers are the O'Keefe brothers, and the O'Keefe brothers get in big trouble for robbing a bus, and Gene is aware of their talents as singers as well. So while he's got them captured, they're in jail and all, you know, and he decides to use them in a radio scene in this particular film. It's hilarious. Also, historically, it's a great opportunity to see Lynn Sly before he you know, made it really big. But he and Gene get into a big fist fight, and Gene throws a punch and knocks Lynn Fly down a hillside and realizes his mistake. And he grabs him at the bottom of this little slope and helps brush him off and says, are you okay, Buck? And he says, my ribs sprained a little bit. And Gene says, well, let's hear you sing. And so he goes, yodel-ay-hoo. He says, well, that's all right. And so the next scene puts them in a singing scenario. It's just absolutely hilarious. But anyway, it's one of the great Autry and Sons of the Pioneers moments. Now, when you go forward looking into the Roy Rogers series, I've got a favorite. It's the motion picture Don't Fence Me In from October 1945. The definitive version of Tumbling Tumbleweeds is performed in that motion picture. And Roy sings, I think, one of the finest arrangements of Along the Navajo Trail, and the Pioneers back him up on that. Wonderful, wonderful piece. And then you get up there and you get into the John Wayne things. Good grief. Rio Grande is still right up there at the top for some great musical numbers showcasing what Stan Jones was all about. So those are my favorites, personal favorite film appearances with the Pioneers.
And what I love about them is it's an eclectic group of movies. You know, you're talking about different ones for different reasons. And I know now I'm going to have to watch the one with Gene Autry and Roy Rogers before he's Roy Rogers, just because of the fist fight. You know, just
oh yeah, worth the price of admission right there, hands down.
The singing cowboy versus the guy before he was the king of the cowboys.
That's right. That's right. You know, and we get this question all the time. People still ask us when we're out touring, they'll say, you know, did Roy and Gene get along in real life? How were they? Were they enemies? Were they friends? What's the deal here? I'm going to tell you right now that a lot of the Hollywood tabloids back in that day would run wild and try to pair the two as being bitter toward one another. But that is as far from the truth as ever. They were both just very genuine and had a great friendship. They hardly ever saw one another though, because they were so busy in their work. But a lot of what catapulted Roy to the top was when Gene enlisted and ended up serving in the Air Force during World War II. That's where Roy became the number one box office selling star and started having all these attendance records at all the big rodeos, Madison Square Garden and Pittsburgh and the Boston Rodeo, and just on and on and on. But then when Gene Autry came back, the two were just still in their prime as actors and singers, and they all had an incredible run that took them well into the 1950s, took them into the television age. And they just had a great respect for one another. And that even showed well into the 1980s, well into the 90s, when they would get together and do reunion projects and things. Gene Autry invited Roy and the Pioneers out to his museum property there at Griffith Park, California in 1992 for a big singing cowboys tribute gathering. It was a 4-hour concert. It was televised on ABC. So yeah, their connection, you know, ran all those years. But anyway, great friendship, hands down.
And that's what you like to hear, because I think the newspapers, and sometimes it's not the papers as much as the picture show, like the companies that ran the pictures, they would sometimes want to keep people in the news, and they would make up these rivalries to say, oh, this is going on. Just like they would say this star and that star were having an affair, just to add some extra spice to it. So people would be like, oh, we got to go see this. And I guess that was, the same thing with back then. I guess we could label it with the height of their popularity with Gene Autry and Roy Rogers. That'd be similar to what people nowadays experience with like Star Trek and Star Wars, and where there are people, you know,
yes.
You can't like one, you know, you only can like one thing. Why not like both? Why can't you enjoy both?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, time went by, and so many other actors, you know, easily saw, you know, they saw great success based off of what Roy had got going, what Gene had got going. And I'm talking like actors such as Monty Hale, also Rex Allen, all had incredible careers that had it not been for Gene and Roy, they would have never took off. And there was even a time there where Ken Curtis, long before he was Festus on Gunsmoke, Ken got kind of into the tail end of the Western motion pictures there, right as Gene Autry was coming back from the Air Force. They signed Ken up to a Columbia Pictures contract as well to do Singing Cowboy Pictures, and he did almost a dozen of them. They were all very fine. But when Autry came back, they told Ken, oh, man, we don't need you anymore. Autry's back from the Air Force. So Ken kind of just slithered away and went back to full-time radio work as a professional singer. And then the Sons of the Pioneers found out about him and brought him into the band in 1949. And a lot of people don't realize that Ken Curtis actually sang on all the Sons of the Pioneers RCA recordings through the early and mid-50s, going up to about 1957. And he had a beautiful voice that blended very, very well with Bob Nolan and Lloyd Perryman and all those guys.
And that's the thing. I think the group has been blessed with able to find people that blend in so well with each other over these 90 years. And that's why I was amazed. Like, only 47 members. You're with people going in and out for various reasons, sometimes health-related, sometimes other things, or other opportunities opened up to them, but then a lot of times they would come back in those periods, and yet you're still able to keep things in the right proper mesh.
Exactly. Yeah. When you saw us there at Frederick, you got to meet Tommy Nally, our lead guitar player. And Tommy's connections with the Pioneers go back way back to the late 60s, actually, because Tommy's older brother, Luther, replaced Pat Brady when Pat retired in 1968 or 69, and Luther came on and was with us as our bass player and tenor singer, and just a beautiful voice all the way around, but he could play any instrument. That was what was so cool. And then things kind of got a little difficult there in the 70s, early 70s. There wasn't as much work, and Luther's trying to, you know, take care of a family and raise his kiddos. And so Luther stepped down, but then several years went by, and fast forward to 1980, and someone had to leave the group. And Dale Warren called Luther up, and Luther said, I came back and I plugged my guitar in. And he said, it was like I never left, you know. So these guys have such a love and appreciation for the music that even if they have to step down for a short period of time, they don't forget the arrangements. They don't forget the music. It stays fresh in their minds. And Luther was a prime example of being able to successfully pull that off.
Now, one of the things I noticed when you guys were introducing each other as the show went on, and Tommy Nally was introduced as the Trail Boss. And I noticed the Trail Boss goes all the way back to Lloyd Perryman as being the first Trail Boss. What exactly does the Trail Boss do for your group? So people know when they hear Trail Boss, what is the Trail Boss job title?
Basically, it's just a term that we came up with, and I don't even think that term really was starting to be used in the Pioneers until later in the 1980s, sometime after Lloyd had even passed away. Lloyd was with us up until 1977, and he had a heart situation that he just did not bounce out of, and we lost him at the young age of 60. But anyway, the Trail Boss, to answer that question, is basically the guy who handles the day-to-day chores, the business side of running a group. All the final decisions go through the Trail Boss, you know, and especially musically, you know, who's going to sing what, who's going to take the solo. It'll also include song selection. It can be phone calls that can range from, okay, we're going to rehearse on this day when we get to the gig, or we'll come out a day early to rehearse, and you know, here's your hotel arrangements. It can even range from, okay, we're going to meet for supper tomorrow night at this place, blah, 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 blah. So the Trail Boss has a lot going on, you know, and then you're keeping up with all the merchandise and all the stock with our current recordings and CDs and the ordering and the purchasing and the people behind the scenes that do everything from graphics to whatnot. And then Tommy, as Trail Boss, even handles just about all of our orders online and mails them directly from his local post office. So there is a lot. It's an everyday deal. You can't just sit aside and let it work itself. There is a lot involved in keeping it going. And Tommy has a lot on his plate, but he does it extremely well. All the Pioneer Trail Bosses have done that.
And obviously, we mentioned you and him as two of the current members of the group. As we go through, if you can mention each person in the group and who they, if you go back the lineage, who was the person that they would have been with the first five? You know, like okay. Who would they have two? If you go all the way back, like who was their great 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 grand pioneer?
Right. Okay. So taking myself, for instance, doing the baritone vocal, you would trace me back all the way vocally to what Bob Nolan's saying in those early years that transitioned to Mr. Tommy Doss throughout the 50s and 60s. Dale Warren, even though he replaced Festus in 1953, Dale started as the lead singer, but then went to the baritone part, the part that I do, and that Dale sang that from the 60s up until 2008. Then Tommy's brother, Luther, did it up until about 2015. Then we had a bass player by the name of Mark Abbott that sang baritone for a while, and then I kind of took that spot. So that's kind of that transition. Tommy Nally as the lead vocalist, which is usually the middle voice part. It's not always the melody, but most of the time it is. With transition from where Roy began vocally, transitioning to Tim Spencer, to Ken Curtis, then to Dale Warren. And then by the time the 1960s rolled around, that middle voice part was being handled by a fiddle player we had by the name of Billy Armstrong, who was phenomenal. He was the guy that really put Orange Blossom Special on the map as a great signature fiddle piece. That went to Lloyd Perryman, who dropped from tenor down to lead. And fast forward into the 80s, Sonny Spencer was with us for a lot of years, sang that middle voice part. And then Luther took it for quite a few years, all the way up to when Randy Rudd came on board in 2001. And then Randy ended up retiring in 2018, and that's when we called Dusty Rogers, Roy Rogers Jr., and he had retired. And it's like, wow, as a son of Roy Rogers, he gets to be in the band that his dad started, and that was just the coolest thing. Dusty has a very powerful voice, and he blended so well vocally with us, and unfortunately, he retired at the end of 2022, and that's where Tommy came on and took the lead vocal position. Our tenor vocalist is Ken Lattimore. He's been with us 26 years, so he sings the part that Lloyd Perryman sang for years and years, and Lloyd was the tenor from 1936 up to the early 60s, and we found a kid from out near Orange County, California, Rusty Richards, who had a great ability to yodel, but he was a high tenor singer that could sing so high Pat Brady said he'd give you a nosebleed. Rusty was with us pretty well up through the early 1980s, and the tenor voice from that point went to Luther, and then our lead guitarist in the 80s, Gary LeMaster, sang the tenor well, actually right up to the time that Ken Lattimore took it. So it's cool when you trace all this back. There's only been like a half dozen fellas that's done each of the vocal parts. And then you've had maybe 8 to 10 fiddle players and about that many bass players. And Tommy takes the lead guitar duties. And we've only had 4 of those. There's only been 4 lead guitar players in 90 years.
That is amazing. That is just amazing. Only 4 lead guitar players in 90 years. But it goes to show that the passion that everybody brings to the group and how they come in there and they enjoy it, and obviously the camaraderie that everybody has.
Yeah, exactly. And then our fiddle player, Paul Elliott, is just unbelievable. We had Hugh Farr for all those years, about 24 years as the fiddler. And then he stepped down in 1959, and we went for a short time with no fiddle player at all, but then grabbed up Rex Allen's fiddler, Wade Ray, who was with us for a spell, then to Billy Armstrong, and then later on in the 80s, Sonny Spencer. We had Ricky Bowen for quite a few years with us, who was a fine Texas-style fiddler, and then we found Paul when Dusty and I joined the group in 2018. And I got to tell you, Paul Elliott's fiddling is so reminiscent of Hugh Farr, our original fiddler, that he can fool me. He fools my wife all the time when we'll be listening to the old recordings, and my wife will say, "That's Paul playing, isn't it?" I said, "No, that's Hugh Farr." You know, so he's just hit a home run with us all the way. Just an outstanding fiddle talent. And when we need an extra voice, if we need a fourth voice or a fifth voice to fatten up the vocal sound, Paul jumps right in and will sing just about anything that's assigned to him. He's got a great voice for that. And then playing the stand-up bass, you know. Bob Nolan played the bass in the early, early years of the Sons of the Pioneers, and then Pat Brady took it. And then by the time Pat retired in the late 60s, Luther was the bass player. When I was a kid growing up, though, I still remember Dale Warren playing bass. He played a Fender electric bass. We had, goodness sakes, by the early 2000s, we had Preston Eldridge on bass, and then Mark Abbott came and played. And then we actually found Chuck Irvin in late 2018, and Chuck lives out on the West Coast. He has a journalism degree. He's a brilliant writer, but helps us in publicity and so many other things as well. And now Chuck, as our current bass player, sings parts and helps us down in the low range. I used to sing bass, and I can still do it, but since now I'm doing nearly all the baritone work and have been blessed to sing a few more of the vocal solos, We've passed the lower vocal end to Chuck, and man, oh man, he's just nailing it beautifully. If you get a chance, listen to our new album recording here that just came out. It's called Campfire Spirituals, and you can definitely hear on some of our quartet arrangements how everything just sounds so perfect. Listen to the recording of Land Beyond the Sun, and you'll get an idea of what Chuck is all about as a vocalist. He's a fine singer, but a superb bass player. So we're very fortunate. We've got five guys that love what they do. They appreciate this, and of course, respect the legacy for one, but just love the music so much that, you know, we just all want to keep doing this forever and ever.
And I hope you guys do keep doing it for a long, long, long time, because obviously there's going to be my generation, but all the other future generations, they get a chance to see it. It'd be kind of cool to see you guys in your 95th year and your 100th year, but I'm hoping you come back to my side of the coast again much sooner than that. I don't want to have to wait forever
see
you guys come back out.
Absolutely. I was looking in my notes trying to think, man, when was the last time we were even up in that area? And I saw that we were in Baltimore and played a concert in there at the Harbor. Gosh, and it was early 1980s. It was like 1982 or 1983, and I found this in one of our fan club newsletters, and 25,000 people showed up to see the Sons of the Pioneers. So I would just be so thrilled to make a few more frequent performances out in y'all's neck of the woods. You guys have got some beautiful country up there.
And one thing, before we start recording, you said you wanted to get back into Pennsylvania, particularly in the Pittsburgh area.
Absolutely. There was a lot of that neighborhood back in the day where we had more success with our Pioneer fan clubs in that region. There was a period of time where we had more fan club members in Pennsylvania than just about any other state. And Pittsburgh was actually the home base for the Sons of the Pioneers fan club during the Second World War. And that all kind of took off in 1943. And our fan club remained out of there up until around 1948. And then we moved it to Los Angeles. But we would come over and do performances at the Sleepy Hollow Park and some of those music parks that are no longer even going. But we always would come and do two or three appearances a year at these concert venues. Thousands and thousands of people would absolutely show up. I mean, you could not find a parking place at these venues when the Pioneers came to town.
And that's the thing. It's like I said, it's just you guys draw crowds. And I think part of it is because people, like on our side of the country, don't get to see you that often. So it's almost like you guys are Disney vaulting us, going back to that term. You know, it's like, well, we're out there.
Yeah.
We're going to hide for a while. Now we're back. You guys need to get the chuck wagons out more often.
I tell you, and we had a gentleman that day there at Frederick, and this was on St. Patrick's Day on the 17th of March when we were there with you guys, and it was so funny. A young gentleman came up to us after the concert from the Cody, Wyoming area or something like that, and he said, this is the first time I've heard cowboy music since I've been away from Wyoming, and he'd only been away for like 5 years or something, but he heard we were coming. He said, I had to come to this because I just had to get my dose of cowboy music. He said, I couldn't stand it any longer. So he was so happy and thrilled to get to see us. It just made his day.
And if people want to see you guys performing, you have some performances coming up later this month in April. Where?
We're going out to Tucson, Arizona. We go out there quite a bit. And let me just back up by saying that that was kind of our winter headquarters back in the day. When I was a kid growing up, the Pioneers played Branson, Missouri in the summers. They would play Tucson, Arizona during the winters and then tour in and around all that still, you know. But Tucson has the famous old Tucson movie studios. And do yourself a favor and Google that and just check out the legacy of big films that have came from that movie location property. But anyway, they're still going and they are bringing back their live concert series this year. It's been probably 6 or 7 years since the Sons of the Pioneers have done performances there, but they called us up and we said, man, we'd be happy to come back. So we're going to be there for 3 nights. And these will be evening concerts on the night, I believe it's the 26th, 27th, and 28th of April. And you can go to our Sons of the Pioneers website at sonsofthepioneers.org and click on the schedule. You can get all the details for that, how to get tickets and everything.
Yeah, definitely, because it's a group you want to see live if you can. And of course, being in Tucson, Arizona, I mean, really, come on. You're in cowboy country, listen to cowboy music. It's you're going to be in hog heaven.
Absolutely. And Tucson is special to us because that's where Bob Nolan went to high school, and that's where Bob wrote Cool Water as a poem back in 1927.
And speaking of Bob Nolan, one of the questions I wanted to ask you, he was extremely prolific with writing songs. How many Sons of the Pioneers songs did he write?
There's not an actual count that I could probably throw at you, but let me just say this, that what got registered for copyright to be performed publicly totaled right at 175 numbers, although Bob said in an interview back in the 70s, he said one day he and his publisher sat down and they tried to write down all the titles, everything that they could possibly think of that Bob had written in his wonderful career. And Bob said, we got up to 1,100 and that's when we quit counting. So it's very, very likely that all that took place. And I'll tell you this. During that time when Bob was in Tucson, he was writing for himself. He was writing for his own enjoyment. He, you know, the demands of Hollywood, those demands working in the films, when all that came in the middle 1930s and he had to meet this deadline that the director threw at him, you know, you got to have this song ready to go by this time and blah, 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 blah. That's when it became work and it wasn't any fun anymore. And so even though Bob did write some fabulous numbers during that run, but by the time they were making those Roy Rogers films in the 40s, Bob was burned out as a writer because he was just tired of having to stick with the demands. It wasn't any fun anymore. He preferred to write for himself. And when he did write for himself, those were the poems and the songs that he would write them down on whatever he had. It might be a note card. It might be the piece of an envelope or something, whatever was handy, because when a lyric came to him, he dropped what he was doing and he wrote it down. And he would store all this away, and he kept it all boxed. It was all in boxes, dozens and dozens of boxes of lyrics, poetry, and whatnot, all stored in his garage. And this was at the residence where he lived, just a few blocks away from Republic Studios, where they were making the films with Roy. And then in early 1949, something happened at his residence, and the garage caught on fire, and he lost all of that.
Oh, my.
And what a blow it was. But even as the 50s and into the 1960s continued, he continued writing, and occasionally he would get with the Pioneers. And Lloyd Perryman from the Pioneers, who was with us forever, Lloyd and Bob were great friends, and they met often. And Bob would say, Lloyd, hey, I've got a new song here for you guys, and I think this might be a great one. And so they would actually still introduce some of Bob's newer material, even going into the 1960s and stuff. But Bob continued writing for himself well through the 1970s, and he always said, someday I'll dust some of these off and maybe let the public hear them. Well, long about 1978, Bob had just turned 70. He was about to turn 71. And a record producer approached him and asked him if he would come out of retirement and cut a solo album. It was the first time Bob had sang on recording in like 17 or 18 years. and he hit a home run with it, but he did some of that newer material that had just been waiting, you know. And Marty Robbins even joined him for this session because Bob was a huge fan of Marty. All the Pioneers just loved Marty Robbins to pieces. And so Bob wanted to record Marty's composition of Man Walks Among Us. So they did. And Marty was actually in L.A. and they timed it perfectly. They actually did a little duet feature in a portion of that song. And then in June of 1980, Bob died from a heart attack coming home from a fishing trip, 72 years of age. And it was just a shock to everybody because up to all that, he was just still in really good health and was starting to do a few appearances at film events and things and kind of coming back out, you know.
It's a shame, but at least he had that one last recording, you know, where it could have been worse. It could have been prior to that. And then
exactly.
The music never heard.
I have a recording that's very dear to me, very special. It's a cassette tape recording of Bob, and he's in his backyard. He's being interviewed by the president of the Sons of the Pioneers fan club there in Hollywood. And this was 6 days before Bob passed away, and Bob recorded on this cassette this new poem that he had written. And I mean, it was a lengthy son of a gun, but he summed up his entire career in this 5-minute segment, and I'm trying not to tear up. He basically expressed in this poem how the desert made a man out of him in just a matter of a few short years. And so anyway, we were fortunate that entire poem got recorded, and then he passes 6 days later. And there was this line toward the end of this poem, and he quoted something to the phrase of, "When I die, I want my ashes scattered in a line out across the desert so that my mistress will find me there." Well, the name of this poem is My Mistress, the Desert. Again, it's all how the desert impacted everything he had dealt with in life. And sure enough, after Bob passed, his family honored those wishes, and he was cremated, and they scattered his ashes out along the California-Nevada line out west of Las Vegas, and actually rented a plane and did that to honor him. And it's like, wow. I mean, I'm sitting here, I just get the chills talking about that. It's very, very moving. Bob was a really interesting man.
Well, I want to thank you for sharing that with me, and I just want to remind listeners that, as you said, the Sons of the Pioneers, yes, 90 years. And they just put out this year a new album, Campfire Spirituals, which you can go to sonsofthepioneers.org and purchase, you know, the CD version. You can also listen to it on things like Spotify and so on, where you have a lot of Sons of the Pioneers songs and albums on there, including Red River Valley, which records a lot of the more traditional songs that are usually most people think of as Sons of the Pioneers. But out of the Campfire Spirituals, what song, you know, because thankfully you gave me permission to use some of the songs of the Sons of the Pioneers, the Interspace during the interview, what song would you want to have highlighted to end the episode with?
Oh, my gosh. I tell you what, I mentioned it a moment ago, The Land Beyond the Sun, I think, is just a beautiful arrangement, and all our voices together. I would possibly also add the a cappella version of the Lord's Prayer. Oh my gosh, that just turned out beautifully. And that was something that we had done at RCA in the early 50s. And a lot of folks had asked about it. And we said, you know, when we were making preparations to cut this new recording project, we got to do the Lord's Prayer. And I think it's just absolutely fine. There's not a flaw in it. And it only took us just a couple of takes when we cut it in the studio, and we nailed it. I'm so thrilled that we were able to put that one on there. Very blessed with it.
Every day the skies are blue, and the grazing's good there too. It's a way off in that land beyond the sun, where the cool clear waters flow, and the tumbleweeds don't blow. Gonna rest there when
wanna be there by sundown. When the big boss calls the cowpokes one by one,
then I'll cross the great divide where the plains are sweeping wide, and I'll head into that land beyond the sun.
When I lay me down at night and the prairie stars are bright, I'll be dreaming of the land beyond the sun. Horse, you're kind of dragging. I know you're tired, so am I. This trail is long, and it's uphill too. But we're gonna make it, pal, and that's for true. So let's keep going till our work's all done, and we reach that land beyond the sun.
Pal and me, we wanna be there by sundown. When the big boss calls the cowpokes one by one,
they've all hit the glory trail, but I'll join them without fail when I head into that land beyond the sun.
And get a feel for what the album's like. And like I always tell people, you know, if you want to stream it, yeah, you can stream it and listen to it. But if you enjoy the album and you want to hear more songs from the Sons of the Pioneers, buy the album itself from them. Because I always look at it, if you really enjoy something nowadays, like with a, whether it's a film, independent filmmaker, and you can watch theirs on streaming, but you know they have the DVD or the Blu-ray, it applies here. I call it the tip. If you really enjoy the music, buy the CD because it's like you're tipping the performer, and that way they get more money to utilize towards making more music or more movies or whatever creative things that they're going into.
Absolutely. That's exactly how it works. And that is the case with just about everybody in the touring industry today. You know, you look at some of the bigger bands, the cost of insurance to run a motor coach and to travel night after night from gig to gig, it's up there. It's huge. And they do rely on that merchandise. Those merchandise sales is what not only keeps the product out there to keep the inventory alive, but it helps with every little thing from fuel to meals. And it's a big thing. Your touring performers just about have to have that or you're not going to make it.
Definitely. And I will say this, at the end of your show, and I think from the way you guys implied it, you do this pretty much at almost all your shows, or at least the vast majority, is when the show's done, they go out and meet everybody. They go out into the front in the lobby area, and you end up in a queue, but you know, waiting for people, but it's well worth the wait because you get to talk to each five of the guys individually. You can get your picture with them. They'll sign stuff for you, and it's just great that you have a couple minutes just about every person. But yet, then, you know, take into account, if you're in the middle or the end of the line, you know, you're going to get your time too. You know, it's not like you're going to be rushing them because they're at the end, but it's just, everything is so nice. And I like how you guys personalize it for each individual audience member that decides to do that.
Well, thank you. We take a great amount of pride. We strive to, you know, spend time with our audiences, and so many of them drive great distances to see us. I mean, for the Frederick performance there on March 17th, there was several that spoke to me afterwards that had driven from locations in Virginia. There was several that came from way over on the west side of Pennsylvania to come all the way to Frederick. So a number of folks did drive some long hours to come see us. And so we're always very, very appreciative of all of that. And we thoroughly, thoroughly enjoy taking the time to just to get to visit and have a yak session for a few minutes. And if it takes 5 hours, who cares? We're not in any big hurry to run off. I tell the audiences that a lot. We're not one of these bands that races off to the hot tub immediately after the closing number. We're here to stay around, and as long as we can visit, we're there to do it.
And I'm thankful that you guys do. And I want to thank you, John, for joining me and talking about the Sons of the Pioneers and giving people an idea of really what is music history, movie history, and it's just American history.
Amen to that. That is absolutely right. There's just something about the love and the lore of the great American West, and we've been very fortunate to get to showcase that in song and all the harmonies all these 90 years. We're so happy we can keep doing it.
I hope everybody enjoyed the episode. I really, really enjoyed talking to John Fullerton. He's agreed to come back on the show again periodically, and we're going to be talking about different movies that the Sons of the Pioneers were in and do discussions about that. Just remember, go to sonsofthepioneers.org to learn more about the group, where their schedule is, their shop, and all that stuff. There's extensive information there about their history, pictures, and so on. I can't recommend it enough. I hope for those that are unfamiliar with their songs, you're now more familiar with them and, you know, seek out the music. I think it touches, it's the part of our soul that as Americans and people that love the Old West really appreciate. As always, you can leave us feedback at diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com or leave us a message on our Facebook page. And I think to take us out, we're going to listen to the Lord's Prayer from their latest album, Campfire Spirituals. So hope everybody has a good day. Thank you all. Bye.
Our Father, which art in evil, for the